Today is Tuesday, February 9th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedofo, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, Myanmar protests continue for the fourth day.
We stand with the people of Burma, support their right to assemble peacefully, including to protest peacefully.
Also ahead, Senate launches second impeachment trial of former President Trump.
The central issue for the Democrats is that it is appropriate constitutional to try a former official.
Plus, COVID health workers battle depression and anxiety in Spain. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the Myanmar. Myanmar's new military rulers signaled their intention to crack down on opponents of their takeover, issuing decrees that effectively banned peaceful public protests in the country's two biggest cities. But demonstrators gathered in the streets of Myanmar's capital again Tuesday for a fourth consecutive day, defying a set of restrictions aimed at stopping the massive protests against the overthrow of the elected civilian government. Tuesday's protests in Naypyidaw occurred just hours after the military announced an 8 p.m. to 4 a.m. curfew will be imposed in the cities of Yangon and Mandalay. The regime has also banned gatherings of more than four people across the country. The U.S. has expressed concern about restrictions on civil liberties in Myanmar and called on the military to restore democratic rule. As thousands continue to protest the military's takeover in several cities, State Department spokesman Ned Price says the administration supports the people's right to assemble.
It is fair to say that we stand with the duly elected representatives of the people of Burma in their efforts to speak for the people of the country. We join them in demanding the immediate and full restoration of the democratically elected government. We stand with the people of Burma, support their right to assemble peacefully, including to protest peacefully in support of the democratically elected government and the right to freedom of expression, including the freedom to seek, to receive, to impart information both online and offline. We're, of course, very concerned about the military's recent announcement restricting public gatherings. As I said before, we strongly support the right of all individuals in Burma and around the world to freedom of expression, association, peaceful assembly, including for the purposes of peaceful protest.
Britain's envoy said on Monday that it had submitted a request for a special session of the UN Human Rights Council to address the crisis in Myanmar, where the military seized power a week ago. Reuters' Emma McCarthy reports.
Myanmar's new military leader said on Monday the ruling junta would hold a fresh election and hand power to the winner, saying that campaigning in a vote last November had not been fair. Police warned protesters to disperse or face force to stifle the demonstrations against the coup. Ambassador Julian Braithwaite told an organisational meeting of the Geneva Forum that it was making the request together with the European Union.
Madam President, we must respond to the calls of the United Nations Secretary General, who has condemned the actions of the Myanmar military and called on its leadership to listen to the will of the people and to refrain from violence and to fully respect human rights and fundamental freedoms. We must react to the calls of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, who has expressed her grave concern about the removal of the civilian government and the arbitrary detention of dozens of political leaders, human rights defenders, journalists, activists, and others by the military.
The United States Embassy in Myanmar said on Monday it had received reports that a curfew had been imposed in the country's two biggest cities, Yangon and Mandalay, after a third day of big protests over last week's coup.
That's Emma McCarthy with Reuters. The Senate launches Donald Trump's historic second impeachment trial Tuesday, with lawyers for the former president insisting he's not guilty of inciting mob violence at the Capitol to overturn the election, where prosecutors say he must be convicted of the, quote, most grievous constitutional crime, unquote, even though he's gone from the White House. Trump faces a charge of incitement to insurrection over the January 9th Capitol siege, an attack that stunned the nation and the world after he encouraged a rally to fight like hell for his presidency. Rioters stormed the building, trying to stop the certification of President-elect Joe Biden's victory. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says he's pleased that Democrats, Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell, and President Donald Trump's lawyers have agreed to a plan to conduct the impeachment trial. According to a Senate resolution on the matter, up to 4 hours will be equally divided between the Democratic impeachment managers and former president's counsel present arguments on Tuesday on the constitutionality of the trial. The agreement then lays out the next steps, including how many hours each side gets to make their case and their closing arguments. Duell Poor is a constitutional law professor at the University of California, Hastings College of Law. He spoke to International Edition Steve Miller about some of the arguments that may be made this week.
The central issue for the Democrats is arguing that it is appropriate constitutional to try a former official. And the brief, I think, does an exemplary job of laying out the prior history, both in Great Britain, from which we got invention of impeachment, and also the intention of the framers and the subsequent history. And it's clear from that that both in Britain, at the time of the drafting of the Constitution, it was the case that former officials could be impeached. And indeed, the principal example of that was the impeachment of Warren Hastings, who had been the first Governor General of India. Warren Hastings was impeached 2 years after he left office. And that specific incident is cited by Colonel George Mason in the debates with James Madison, which led to the adoption of the language high crimes and misdemeanors.
That appears to answer the constitutionality question of whether or not to hold this impeachment trial. But what about the other issue that the Democrats have to face, this article of impeachment where they claim that the president incited an insurrection at the U.S. Capitol? What is the legal bar that they have to surpass?
Defenders of the president will argue that the president's statements about the stolen election were protected speech under the First Amendment. And what the Democrats have to argue is that it was not protected speech, that it was incitement to insurrection, which would not be protected speech. To meet that bar, they have to show that the president intended to cause imminent lawless action and that imminent lawless action was likely to occur. Now, we know that imminent lawless action did in fact occur, but the question really turns on what was the president's intention. And it really comes down to how do we interpret the words the president spoke when he said, if you don't fight like hell, you won't have a country anymore, and then encouraging them to march onto the Capitol.
So that kind of addresses the legal issues surrounding the trial, but can you go into a little bit more detail about the trial and perhaps maybe something that the casual observer may not know?
The Constitution says that the Senate has the sole power to try all impeachments. It uses those words, the sole power. And nowhere else in the Constitution does it refer to the Senate having the sole power to do anything. What those words mean in the context of the Constitution is that the Senate's judgment is not reviewable by any court. When people like, for example, Senator Lindsey Graham say that it would be unconstitutional for the Senate to try a former official, that's a red herring. Anything the Senate does is constitutional because the Senate does it. The Senate's own rules provide that the Senate must try all impeachments. Any impeachment articles that the Senate receives, the Senate must, the following day at 1 p.m., begin the trial. The Senate has chosen to tie its hands in this matter. And so the decision to hold the trial is not a decision that senators can reasonably object to unless they are prepared to change their own rules. And the Supreme Court, if there were any question about this point, the Supreme Court in a case called Nixon versus United States said specifically by a unanimous vote that the judgments of the Senate in an impeachment trial are not subject to review by any court. They're not justiciable.
That's Joel Paul, a constitutional law professor at the University of California, Hastings College of Law. He spoke with my colleague, Steve Miller. This is the Voice of America. Afghan officials say a string of attacks has killed 5 government employees and 4 policemen. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the attacks on Tuesday in the capital, Kabul. Gunmen opened fire in the Bagh El Daud neighborhood and killed 4 employees of the Ministry of Rural Development. A Danish man convicted of torturing and murdering a Swedish journalist on his homemade submarine has been given a 19-month sentence for his attempt to escape from a suburban Copenhagen prison last year, during which he threatened prison officials and staff and police with a fake gun and fake explosives. Peter Madsen was quickly apprehended on October 20th outside the prison, where he is serving a life sentence for the killing of Kim Wall. The conviction will not be added to the life sentence. You are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. A member of the World Health Organization team investigating the origins of COVID-19 says full access was granted in Wuhan, China. AP correspondent Mike Grecia reports.
A member of the World Health Organization team that's in Wuhan, China, investigating the origins of COVID-19, tells the Associated Press the team was granted full access to all sites and personnel they requested.
I didn't expect to get that level of openness.
Peter Daschak, a disease ecology expert, says the team thoroughly inspected the seafood market that was linked to early COVID-19 case clusters.
We were in the toilets, in the air vents, looking down under the grids.
The WHO team plans to present a summary of findings before departing China next Wednesday. I'm Mike Gracia.
Also on Tuesday, the WHO delegation's leader says there is no evidence the virus accidentally leaked out from a laboratory in China and that it most likely came to humans from an animal that contracted it from bats. However, that source has not been yet confirmed. Many overworked Spanish medics are still reeling from the mental trauma of treating sick COVID-19 patients during the first wave of the virus. For some, overcrowded hospital wards and high death rates have brought on depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder. Lauren Anthony of Reuters reports.
Richard Belmonte is a nurse, and he hasn't treated a COVID patient for 8 months. But the mental trauma from working in the intensive care unit at Barcelona's Vall d'Hebron Hospital during the first wave of the pandemic still lingers.
When I arrived at the COVID-19 ICU, my first sensation was fear of the unknown. I didn't know what I was facing. Colleagues who'd arrived before me came out, and I remember the words that one colleague of mine said, "This is a battlefield. This is a battlefield."
As the pandemic drags on, the emotional toll for health workers on the front line is receiving increased scrutiny. Spain is one of the worst hit, and the effects aren't always contained to the workplace. In Belmonte's case, it's also more personal. Not only was he forced to live away from his family to protect them from COVID-19, but both of his parents fell ill with the virus. For his dad, the disease was fatal.
My mother and father were in the same room with COVID, and my father didn't make it. I'm angry. I couldn't take care of him because I'm a nurse. I like to take care of people, and I couldn't do it for my father.
A recent study of 9,000 professionals in 18 hospitals in Spain showed that around 45% of healthcare staff there were at high risk of some type of mental disorder after just the first wave of the virus, and that 3.5% of them had suicidal thoughts. Depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder were the most common complaints. Dr. Eduard Vieta is the head of a Barcelona clinic which was part of the study. He said although the hospital offered counselling, getting medics to come off the COVID front line was tough because they don't see their limits.
There are certain prejudices and difficulties for professionals and for people in general to admit that one has psychological problems because they're perceived as a weakness, as a personal fault, instead of admitting that it's a health problem like any other.
Belmonte refused counselling, choosing to tackle his struggles with the help of his family instead. Despite everything, he says he would happily treat COVID patients in ICU in the future.
Thus, Lauren Anthony of Reuters. World powers welcomed an agreement by Libya's rival political groups to form a new interim unity government headed by Abdel Hamid Beiba, a powerful business leader from the western city of Misrata. A surprise came from within Libya when the self-styled Libyan National Army, led by Khalifa Haftar, congratulated the interim government through a UN brokered process. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Wolfgang Pertzai, former military attaché in Libya, about these developments and what they mean for Libya's future.
I would not say that the situation is now much worse than before for Haftar as an individual. He was never ever on good terms with Sarraj. Allegedly, the Beiba recently visited Benghazi and probably also talked with him. Saleh's influence is heavily undermined. This is also not too bad for Haftar for his reputation in the East. LNA spokesman Ms. Mari said yesterday that the supreme commander of the LNA is the new presidential council. But for the real reaction, Haftar will wait and see what the new government will do and how, especially how the people on the streets and the tribal leaders in the East will react. I would say, and this is my advice for the new government, regarding the Cyrenaica, this is not about getting Haftar as a person on board, but about getting the people in the East on board. Haftar will not act against what he perceives the will of the people and the will of the Eastern tribes.
Would he still be the chief of the army?
This is quite likely, because he will claim that he is appointed by the House of Representatives and not by the Supreme Commander. And I have no doubt that the House of Representatives, which is located in the East under Aguila Saleh, will still keep him as the commander because they certainly share common interests with him.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi welcomed the new interim government in Libya and took credit for the red line he drew in Libya last year as a contribution to the progress in Libya. Is that a fair claim by Sisi?
I fully agree with him. Actually, his declaration, his credible declaration of the red line, certainly contributed to the stabilization of the front line. Operation Volcano, supported by Turkey, was about to attack Sirte and advance further on to the east. Actually, there were at least two major attempts of Operation Volcano to advance and take Sirte. If al-Sisi would not have declared his red line, I have no doubt that they would have made a major attempt to attack the east. And this could have, or I would even say, this would have certainly led to an escalation. Right now, regardless if the Dabeiba government succeeds or not, right now, there is the chance of consolidation of the ceasefire. Because right now, everyone in the East and in the West, also among the military leaderships, supports the Dabeiba and the UN, at least officially. And right now, this would be the perfect opportunity for a consolidation. This means to implement such a ceasefire monitoring, a civilian cease monitoring mission as proposed by UN Secretary Guterres. So this is the chance to achieve really a progress with regard to consolidation of the ceasefire. And this is maybe even more important than the current political developments.
The United States called on Turkey, Russia, and the United Arab Emirates to stop their military intervention.
This is a very wise move. And actually, I've advised already the previous government and some of my contacts in the current administration about this, that if you want to get rid of Russia in Libya, you need to make them unimportant for the East. The reason why they are there is because they are providing the backbone of the Air Force and technical support and so on and so on. They need this technical support in the Air Force as long as they are worried about an eventual attack from the West. If the ceasefire is consolidated, there would be no need for the Emirates to continue to pay for Wagner. I doubt that Russia would maintain its presence in Libya if they are not being paid by the Emirates. But they will only withdraw if Turkey also withdraws. So the demand by the Secretary of State that both shall withdraw makes absolutely sense. It is unlikely, and I would rule it out, that Turkey will withdraw and Russia stay. I would also rule out that Wagner will withdraw or the Emirates will stop paying for them if the Turks are still on the other side. So this is about allowing somehow Turkey to maintain its strategic interests in Libya, namely the economic interests. If Turkey is able to sustain its economic interests, to continue with the contracts and so on and so on, I would consider it really as realistic that they will withdraw the majority of their footprint in Libya.
That's VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy speaking with Wolfgang Putzai, former military attaché in Libya. UN human rights experts are calling for the repatriation of tens of thousands of women and children held in squalid conditions in northern Syria's Al-Hol and Rojh refugee camps. Lisa Schwein reports for VOA from Geneva on the camps, which are run by U.S.-backed Kurdish forces.
UN experts describe the conditions as subhuman and that under international law, the situation may reach the threshold of torture, inhuman and degrading treatment. Fanula Niolin is an expert on countering terrorism and says the matter is of extreme urgency.
The structures are poor and flimsy. The risk of pneumonia and serious illness for children in particular is high. Water conditions and scarcity is a fact of life. Latrine and other basic human necessities are under severe stress.
The camps house more than 64,000 people. The vast majority are women and children. Al-Hol is the larger camp for refugees and Syrians who have fled their homes, with nearly 62,000 residents. Most are women and children of Syrian and Iraqi origin. Niolin says violence in the camps has increased in recent weeks, and the first four cases of COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, have been identified. She warns of the extraordinary challenges posed by the coronavirus should the outbreak take hold. UN officials say the women and children in these camps are viewed with suspicion. The officials say countries are reluctant to repatriate them because most are family members of former Islamic State militants. In an effort to change their position, nearly two dozen human rights experts have sent a letter to 57 states urging them to bring their nationals home. Niolin says these 57 states, for the first time, have been named together in hopes of shaming them into action. Counterterrorism expert Niolin says it is unconscionable that the women and children are forced to live under these conditions by virtue of their family connections. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Egyptian authorities on Saturday released a journalist working for Qatar's Al Jazeera television network who was held in pretrial detention for more than 4 years. Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters reports.
Egyptian authorities on Saturday released the Al Jazeera journalist Mahmoud Hussein after 4 years in pretrial detention. Hussein, an Egyptian national who had been based in Qatar's capital Doha, was arrested whilst on holiday in Cairo at the end of 2016. Hussein was accused of spreading false news, joining a banned movement, and receiving foreign funds. Hussein's brother Naga and lawyer Taha Abu al-Nasra said a court in Cairo had ordered his release with, quote, precautionary measures. While it was not clear what those will be, Naga Hussein said his brother may have to spend several hours a week in a police station. In a statement, Qatar's Al Jazeera television network welcomed the news of Hussein's release. It said, "No journalist should ever be subjected to what Mahmoud has suffered for the past 4 years for merely carrying out his profession." His release comes after Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain and Egypt agreed to restore diplomatic trade and travel ties with Doha last month. Connections had been severed in 2017 over allegations that Qatar supported terrorism. Doha has denied those charges. Egypt has been accused by the Committee to Protect Journalists of putting reporters behind bars to stifle dissent. It said 27 were imprisoned there as of late last year, but Egyptian authorities say legal action has been taken only against those who break the law.
That's Flora Bradley Watson of Reuters. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Thank you so much for listening and have a great day.